think I can handle it?
Very good then, Mr. McGinnis. Welcome to my world.
Gathered together from the cosmic reaches of the universe, here in this great hall of justice.
And with that, welcome to another edition of the Hall of Justice. This is episode number 6, and hopefully you're listening on iTunes, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio, or somewhere else other than my Twitter page. I'm Seth Everett, and this is a great one. This is going to be cool. I've said that a lot, but so far the guests have been very responding well. I'll tell you a quick story, and then I'll introduce the guest, because this is an interview that was taped this weekend in Sacramento, California, at Wizard World. We were doing a segment on ConTV about the role of females in comics and superheroes and television movies, the whole thing. And my outstanding producer on ConTV, Nash Harrington, he booked this lovely lady as one of the guests. Well, first of all, it was Trina Robbins, who's an outstanding artist. She also calls herself a herstorian. Janice Davis, one of my pals, we'll get her on the show very soon. She was great as well. And then there was Nikki Wheeler Nicholson. And Nikki, she was lovely. She was great. She did a great job on the show. But when I was introduced to her, it was her grandfather was the founder of DC Comics. I said, get out of here. Really? That's a story in its own right. And on ConTV, we couldn't really get into that because that wasn't relevant to the segment that she was a guest for. So we did the segment, and I said to her afterwards, I would love to get you on this podcast that I'm starting up. And, you know, we've had 5 episodes so far. It's been cool. She was ridiculously receptive. She was outstanding, and she tells great stories. Now, just as teaser, not only do I ask her about how the comics company started, but then her grandfather's reaction and the story behind meeting Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, Bob Kane and Bill Finger, and the whole Kane Finger saga in the creation of Batman. We also even talked about William Moulton Marston, which to me is a podcast in its own right because that's a great story. William Moulton Marston, the creator of Wonder Woman, also the inventor of the lie detector, and was in a permanent live-in threesome, and was into bondage. It just there you go. Wet your palate. So we can talk about that. But Nikki is great. Her grandfather is Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson. He's a distinguished military officer. He's an inventor, a prolific writer of comic strips and pulp stories, and then became a publisher and created the modern comic book in 1934. So with that, it's a great story. I hope you'll tune in for the whole thing. You'll dig it because the stories she tells are fascinating. So let's listen in my conversation at Wizard World Sacramento with the lovely Nikki Wheeler Nicholson.
First of all, thank you so much for giving me a couple of minutes. You were a rock star on ConTV. Have you done TV before? Because you look like a pro.
Yes. I started out in theater many years ago, and I was an actress in New York, acting mostly in lawyers' offices as a secretary and that sort of thing. But yes, I've had a lot of training.
Well, I don't, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but do you watch the show Mad Men? Do you see? I mean, is that something that we're connecting the dots? I could not believe the way some women were spoken to that way.
Oh yeah, my mother, who is a very interesting woman.
She's still with us.
She's still with us, just barely, but she's still there. Had a really great career as she worked for the United Nations, and she was in Israel when they created the State of Israel. And she warned me from an early age, don't learn to type. But I did.
That's very funny. Your grandfather.
Yes.
Tell me about him.
He was an amazing person. I didn't really know him personally. I just know him from my family stories, and of course, because it's in my gene pool.
Wait, so he died before you were born?
Well, my parents were divorced when I was very young, and so I really didn't know that side of my family until I was older. And my father kept all my grandfather's letters and things of that nature, and when he and I reconnected as an adult, he had saved all this material for me. So that's what started me off. I have a background in history, and so it was just natural for me to want to learn as much as possible.
So for a history buff, you find out one day, I mean, one day you were already an adult. You were already a career person. Am I assuming? Okay, so you have a life. You are a successful adult, and you find out that your grandfather founded.
Well, I knew that as a child.
For our listeners, founded DC, what became DC Comics?
Right. I had a vague understanding of it as a child. I didn't really completely understand it, but I knew he had something to do with Superman. I just didn't understand what it was. And it was only after I was an older person in New York and with my family and that I started to find out more about him. And my family, surprisingly, the mythology around him, there were a lot of inaccuracies. And so I've really been the person in my family who's discovered lots of things about him that no one knew.
And because you set out to do so.
Yes, because I set out to do so.
So take us through the origin story, for lack of a better phrase. So he was with another person, with a group of people, and they started publications?
Well, originally, he was in the military. He had a very unusual and adventuresome military career. He was chasing Pancho Villa on the Mexican border under Black Jack Pershing before World War I. He commanded Troop K of the African American Buffalo Soldiers. He was in the Philippines in about 1915 fighting the Muslim Moros. And then he was in Russia during about 1916 to 1917 during the Bolshevik Revolution. So he had a very, very interesting military career. And then he started, in about 1924, he started writing adventure stories for pulp fiction.
This is 1920?
About 1923, 1924. And he was so successful at that that he and my grandmother, who was Swedish, went back to Europe, and they lived in France for a while. But then the Depression hit, so they had to come back to the United States. He was always interested in graphic representations. In 1926 and 27, he started a newspaper syndicate. And what they did is the newspaper syndicate did graphic representations of novels like The Three Musketeers, Treasure Island. He was the first person to do a comic of Treasure Island. So all the Robert Louis Stevenson scholars cite him for that. So he was already thinking about comics way before the 30s.
Before they were comics. Fast forward, because we could do this. We could be here all day. And
So
how did it become a company?
He decided he wanted to put out original artwork and original scripts. When he got back to the States, there were comic books on the stands, but they were reprints from the newspapers. And he decided that there needed to be original scripts, original artwork. So he started a company to do that.
And I can just imagine, though, how he found Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, Bob Kane and Bill Finger. Like, how does he... So he has a group. He hires somebody. They're doing westerns and they're doing different types of books, and they're coming out until we get to Superman. Correct.
Well, what happened is Jerry Siegel was really interested in pulp, in the pulps.
Right.
So he knew about my grandfather from the pulps. Okay. So when he saw that my grandfather was publishing comics, he and Schuster sent my grandfather that original drawing that was on butcher paper, wallpaper type thing.
With the two ends and,
yes,
and the bald.
Yes. So my grandfather was the first publisher to see that drawing. And he knew immediately that it was a very powerful archetype. So he hired Siegel and Schuster, but before they put out Superman, he felt that they needed development. So he started giving them ideas. He started giving them ideas for strips, and they put out comic strips under his guidance, and then Superman came out.
Right, and we've all seen that iconic now, that first image. How much of this is from stuff that you had to learn versus stuff that you found that day?
A lot of it is that I've learned.
Over time, just through research.
I've been researching this for 15, 16 years now.
I mean, fascinating. How much fun is that?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's really great. I enjoy it, and I love the people that I work with and meet.
Have you ever considered making a fictional movie about this?
I'm working with a writer named Gerard Jones who wrote Men of Tomorrow. And we're working on a biography of my grandfather that's called Lost Hero. And everybody keeps saying it should be a movie. So we'll see what happens.
Look, just if you think about this movie, a period piece from the 1920s and 30s, about a guy who wants to put out magazines, and then you could have him meet
right.
a fictional Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, and then meet Bob Kane and Bill Finger. I mean, far be it from me, but it seems like it's a really fascinating story. I'm jumping ahead, but I have to ask, do you have any recollection through your research of the interactions between your grandfather and William Moulton Marston?
No, you know, and I keep looking for that because I'm very close friends with Pete Marston, Bill's one of Bill's sons, and
really,
oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we are sort of considered comic book families,
sure.
So it's kind of natural that we gravitate towards one another.
Well, the interesting part about it is. And I've read a lot about Wonder Woman throughout the years, but he's known as the inventor of the lie detector.
Yeah.
But he's also known for this sordid life where he had the...
Sordid. I don't think it was sordid at all. I think it was way before its time. I think from what I know about the family, it was just a very unusual situation.
It wouldn't be as unusual if we found out about it today. If the writer of Wonder Woman had that lifestyle where he had the wife and the girlfriend.
I think it was more than that. I think they were really a family. And I think his wife, Betty, Elizabeth, was a very, well, they both were. Both Olive and Betty were very intelligent women. And you can imagine.
It wasn't a scam.
No, not at all. In fact, Betty had a very successful career for a long time. Well, in the 40s, for a woman to be able to have a career like that and have children,
kind of unheard of.
Yes. So it must have worked out very well for them.
I always love the connection to that. I mean, look, I'm not naive to the world. So that's not the shocking part. The shocking part is that that's the basis for how he created Wonder Woman, that she loses her power if she's tied up.
There are those aspects to it. But you know, when I was a little girl, I never saw any of that. You don't notice that as a child. You don't see that aspect of it. I just thought she was an amazing character, and I identified with her a lot.
I was raised correctly. You never ask a woman her age. Are you? You were an adult by Super Friends? No, you were. I don't know how else to ask.
Let's put it this way: I'm of a certain age. Okay. I'm a baby boomer.
Okay, all right. Enough said.
Yeah.
So I see through. You saw I had to ask the question. I'm thinking, how do you properly ask the question? Okay, take me to the end of his run with DC Comics, because when he leaves depends on my next line of questioning. It's way before any of the legal ramifications between the Siegels and the Schusters or Bob Kane and Bill Finger. That's all way past his time.
That was all rooted in what happened to my grandfather. One of the problems is that my grandfather, his contracts with the people that worked for him were similar to the pulp contracts, which were first North American serial rights. So that was kind of standard of the day for the fiction writers. So they would sign these things. Sometimes they never even signed a contract. They just signed the back of a check. But it was understood that it was first North American serial rights. So that's what Jerry and Joe Schuster had with my grandfather. The rights reverted back to them with him. And my grandfather, it never occurred to him to grab on to all of their work. He was not that type of person.
It wasn't that, you can't blame somebody for thinking something that never would have been, it would have been forethought. You never would have conceptualized. What do you know about, because we can go in depth about Siegel and Schuster, but I want to also do justice to Bill Finger. Do you know anything with regard to any decisions that were made that they didn't include Bill Finger on? In your research, did you find, was Bob Kane in any way responsible for that? Bill Finger, for our listeners, first of all, look him up. It's a fascinating story. Created Robin, created the Joker, did so much of Batman's history. I'm just kind of wondering.
I know a little bit, because, of course, I know Athena, his granddaughter. And so I know
everybody's granddaughter.
We've done a panel, the granddaughters.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that would be so much fun.
But so I know from being on panels and hearing what other people say, but you know who you should talk to is Tom Andre, who's going to be here tomorrow. He's going to be doing a couple of panels. He was Bob Kane's biographer.
Oh, okay.
So you should really, you should.
That would be great, yeah.
Yeah, you should definitely talk to him because
Introduce best friend?
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. Yeah. Because he's very knowledgeable about all of that, and he can give you some really good information.
It's a really fascinating thing, and I you weren't there and I wasn't there, so I don't think we're educated enough to. All I can say is I hear what Denny O'Neill says, and I hear what Neil Adams says, and I listen to that. And I take it at value, but it's fascinating to be able to go back and hear, like, if there was a journal that said, "Man, I love that Bill Finger. He's so smart." Something like that.
Part of the problem with comics history is just this exact sort of thing, which is that there's a lot of oral history, which is great. But you can't totally go by the oral history.
It's people's memories.
Yeah, and people have different memories, and then over time, things are colored in different ways. So you have to be really careful about the oral history aspect. That's true for me, too, from hearing stories from my family. One of the reasons why I really have done so much research into records and legal documents and all that kind of thing, because you need backup.
Do you, forgive me for not knowing, and if you want, I'll edit this out. Do you have children?
No.
You have no children.
No.
Are you, is this a passion project for you? Is this something that you've turned into a career for you?
I started out in theater, and then I got into publishing, and I've worked as an editor and a ghostwriter for a really long time. And this started out as a passion, but it has kind of become a career at this point in my life, and I totally love it.
You just adore the time and, you know, questions like this.
The people, yeah. You know, I really, it's just, it's great.
It's fascinating for me as someone who has a sports background. This was always something that was a passion. I always tell the story. In the 90s, I was asked for a campus university television station. I was asked to go to a comic store in 1992 to cover, quote unquote, I put quotes around that, to cover the death of Superman. 1992, death of Superman. I was a Super Friends person. I grew up with Super Friends. I knew who the characters were. I'd seen Superman the movie. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. But that was as far as I got. And I remember interviewing these knuckleheads who were crying. These people. And I said, what is this? But when I was there, when we were waiting, I think, for the store owner, I saw The Dark Knight Returns. And I saw some of these adult books. And then if you remember in The Death of Superman, Hal Jordan goes bananas. And I was like, this is not Super Friends. Like, these are totally different. And it became, you know, a side passion. And if you had told me in 1992 that 20 plus years later, there'd be a network called Con TV.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Right.
We're talking about Supergirl. Like, we were negotiating a peace treaty the way we were talking about Supergirl. And it. That, to me, is fascinating, like the way the genre has gone. So because this has been a process, this isn't something that's brand new, my last question to you is, did you find that the growth of the genre encouraged this activity of yours, or did you like it better when it was quieter?
Well, I have a mixed feeling about that. And sometimes when I go to these things, I get a little concerned that there's a lack of depth occasionally. And I wonder if there's just too much focus on the popularity of it. But then I meet really nice people who are very interested in the history and who are really interested in art. And that's, I think, one thing that really strikes me, if you think about this, here are all these incredible artists, and here's just people, the public, and they can walk down these aisles and they can buy a piece of original art. Now, how great is that? How great is that?
It's fascinating. It's... It raises another issue, which, you know, I've done other segments on and I've done other podcasts on, which is this phrase. I'll just throw this phrase at you because I'm curious to get your perspective. Change for change's sake. There is a psychology. I could show you an article one day. There's a psychology behind the recent changes. The DC has changed. Marvel's changed. This one's changed. They took the ears off the Flash. They took the ears off Captain America. Whatever it is, they took the underwear away from Superman. Whatever it is, change for change. And I call it change for change's sake, that no one's ever satisfied with the status quo. And whatever it is, whatever your capsule is, if you're Linda Carter, if you're Christopher Reeve, whatever it is, that's yours. But don't expect the generations to follow, because I hardly recognize Wonder Woman anymore. I've seen a little bit of Superman in this new 52, whatever they call it. He's obnoxious. I have no interest in him. And I find that, and I'm curious from your perspective, because you could make that argument from the 30s to the 50s. You could make the argument from the 60s to the 80s. Is it cyclical? Is it just that's a generational thing? Or is there something that's changed in the medium right now?
Well, I think you have to look again at what you're talking about. You're talking about DC, Warner Brothers, and Marvel, Disney. These are two giant corporate entities. And I think a lot of the decisions that are made are corporate driven that have to do with, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not making a judgment about it, because I know a lot of people who are very happily and gainfully employed.
Sure, sure, sure. Oh,
thank goodness. So, but that is an aspect of it. However, at the same time, having these two entities also creates a whole other environment for independent artists. So it's not just the two of them. And I think that that's where the innovation happens, is in the independent artists. For instance, there's a wonderful artist named Dean Hashbill, who has a fabulous, he's at Hang Dye Studios in New York. And he's now doing The Fox.
Okay.
And so he's bringing, he and Mark Waid. Yep. So they're bringing a really interesting point of view to something that is coming out of a corporate entity. So
interesting. No, it's a fascinating subject, and it's something that you watch because I love the attention being paid to it.
Yes.
But And I said this, I didn't say it on Con TV, but I was almost hypocritical in that another dinosaur movie? Really?
Yeah.
Sometimes again, it just feels like it gets recycled. And
it's a corporate decision. Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's where the bucks are, so that's where it's going to be.
Thank you so much for doing this. I hope you had fun. I hope you'll come on again.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a real blast. It's really a pleasure meeting you.
Yeah, it's really nice to meet you too. You did a great job.
Kurt Nicholson right here on the Hall of Justice. And it's a great story. You can follow her on Twitter. There's much, much more to come. And I promise you that we'll have her on again. She's too interesting not to have her on again. That'll do it for this edition of the Hall of Justice. We're back on iTunes. We're going to have much, much more. I'm Seth Everett. This has been fun, man.